The U.S. imposes sanctions on dozens of entities based in different countries, including China, over their cooperation with Iran. Russia confirms firing a wave of missiles against Ukraine, saying that the strikes were performed in retaliation for Kyiv's attacks on its border. Tensions run high in Israel as protesters rally as part of what they call a day of resistance against dictatorship. This is World News, coming to you from our studios at our headquarters with me, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Now, top stories are the U.S. imposing new sanctions on several entities and an individual over code connections with Iranian industries. The sanctions target 45 companies based in countries like the UAE, Turkey, China, and Iran. Washington claims that the firms maintain relations with Iran's petrochemical and aerospace industries and help them access global banking systems. Some of the companies are accused of involvement in Iran's drone production. Washington says it will continue to target the Islamic Republic's global network. The U.S. claims that Iran is supplying drones to Russia for war in Ukraine. Tehran dismisses the allegation and says the drones were sent before the war as part of a military cooperation with Moscow. Okay, from Pittsburgh, let's bring in Daniel Kovalik. He's a professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Daniel, good to have you with us. So, sanctions on top of sanctions, this has been going on for years and years and years, and the result, I don't know. I mean, why shouldn't the U.S. learn from the mistakes it made in the past? And it's also proven that the sanctions directly or indirectly impact the lives and the standard of living of the people more than it does on the officials.
Yeah, well, the U.S. government knows that. I mean, there's been multiple studies that, one, sanctions don't work to create political change in other countries. In fact, it tends to harden the position of other countries. And two, they do cause human suffering, particularly to the most vulnerable, to women, to children, to people, to the disabled, to people with health problems. The U.S. is quite aware of this. I mean, so I guess the only conclusion you can draw is that the intended result is to cause human suffering, right? It's just to inflict suffering on the targeted country, that if they can't change that country, they can't overthrow the government in that country, they're going to make the people suffer for, living in it and, I guess ostensibly is supporting the government.
Okay. And Daniel, Washington is saying that they are imposing the sanctions because they say that these companies maintain relations with Iran's petrochemical and aerospace industries. So what's wrong with petrochemistry or aerospace? I mean, should we also shut down NASA or impose sanctions on the U.S.? Or also, some of the companies are accused of involvement in Iran's drone production. And Iran has said that drone was part of the cooperation months before this Ukraine-Russia war. And the U.S. should understand this, right? Because they are sending most sophisticated weaponry to Ukraine to continue the fight with Russia.
Yes, of course. I mean, that's incredible hypocrisy here. The U.S. and other Western countries are sending billions and billions of dollars of assistance and weaponry to Ukraine, and so even if Iran were sending drones to Russia, what is the violation there? So again, I think one has to conclude that it has more to do with targeting Iran itself. I think the U.S. is upset that Iran is, maintaining its economy by selling oil to countries like China. That Iran is enduring, and they're trying to find ways to continue to punish Iran and its people and its economy.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Daniel Kovalik, Professor of International Human Rights from Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. Moving on, Iran's foreign minister and his delegation are in Syria on the second leg of a regional tour. Hossein Abdullahian has met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Early in the day, he visited Latakia, a city in northwestern Syria that was worst hit by the deadly February quake. The Iranian officials said that the Iranian Red Crescent Society and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps have provided aid to the Syrian people since the quake first hit the country. Amin Abdullahian visited Turkey before his trip to Syria. Russia confirming having fired a wave of missiles against Ukraine. It says that the strikes were in response to Kiev's attacks on its border early this month.
In response to the March 2nd terrorist actions organized by the Kiev regime in the Bryansk region, Russia's armed forces dealt a massive retaliation strike. High-precision, long-range, air, sea, and land-based weapons, including the hypersonic missile system Kinjal, hit key elements of Ukraine's military infrastructure, military and defense factories, as well as energy facilities, providing resources to these facilities.
Konashenkov says that all the assigned targets were hit. According to Ukraine officials, four people got killed in the western Lviv region. Key energy infrastructure and residential buildings were also hit in Kharkiv and Odessa. The strikes that started on Wednesday also left 40% of residents in capital Kiev without power. Moscow has accused Kiev of making a new provocation by cutting off the power supply to Zaporizhia, a nuclear plant that's under Russia's control. But the Ukrainian power company has blamed the outage on a Russian missile strike. Shooting in Tel Aviv leaves three people injured, and one of them is in critical condition. We just had reports on protest rallies going on in Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities, and it's getting bigger and getting more violent at the same time. Today we had mounted police trying to push the people away, and also they used water cannon, they tear gas, they kind of choked one of the ralliers, and now this is the latest that we're getting. Three of them have been injured, one of them is in critical condition, and we'll keep an eye on that and bring an update. Now moving on, Russia rejecting a U.S. media report that a pro-Ukraine group was likely behind last year's attack on the undersea Nord Stream gas pipelines.
As for the pro-Ukrainian angle, you know, the idea that some Dr. Evil organized it, that's hard to believe. It was a too difficult task, which probably only a well-trained special state service was capable of, and there are not too many of them in our world.
The Kremlin spokesman also demanded a quick and transparent investigation into the blast, adding that Russia must also be involved in that. Peskov discarded a U.S. report that Moscow could have orchestrated attacks. He said those responsible for the, quote, terrorist act must be identified. On Tuesday, the New York Times cited U.S. intelligence authorities as saying that the Ukrainian group might have carried out the attacks on the pipelines. The report presumed that the saboteurs were most likely Ukrainian or Russian nationals or a combination of both. Kiev responded by denying any involvement. Russia has been pressing for international probe since American investigative journalists alleged that Washington was behind those incidents. Israeli police have clashed with protesters in a demonstration against judicial reforms proposed by the far-right cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The police used tear gas to disperse the crowd. Several people were also arrested in a demonstration that blocked a major highway to the airport. Protesters gathered there in public display of anger at Netanyahu's overseas trip. Demonstrators also disrupted a visit by the U.S. Defense Secretary. Protest organizers had called for traffic jams as part of what they called a day of resistance against dictatorship. Many other main intersections were also clocked. For weeks, the regime has witnessed major rallies against Netanyahu's judicial reforms. Critics argued that legal changes would encourage corruption and diplomatic isolation for the regime. Israeli forces have shot dead three more Palestinians in a pre-dawn raid on the occupied West Bank. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, the killings took place near the flashpoint city of Jenin. The victims were identified as three young Palestinians aged 26, 25, and 22. Jenin and its surrounding areas have been repeatedly targeted by the regime forces in recent months. The attack on the West Bank has increased since the formation of the regime's tight right-wing cabinet under Prime Minister Netanyahu. The new deaths bring to 77 the number of Palestinians killed in the occupied territory so far this year. Tel Aviv has been intensifying its atrocities against Palestinians with impunity. Political commentator and activist Megan Apier says that Israel's growing rate of killing the people in occupied territories is part of its policy of reducing the Palestinian population.
It's noteworthy that the great majority of killings this year have been by the army, relatively few by settlers. So it's still very much an official policy to have this increased rate of killing at the moment. I mean, what can one say? The United Nations Human Rights Council published a report, one of many, many similar reports, and they said that during the Great March of Return, the Israelis were killing women and children and journalists and medical workers, knowing who they were. They were very clear who they were. And this is Israeli policy to kill these categories, but also, of course, to kill anybody who dares to resist. And this army, when they kill Palestinians, and they do kill children quite deliberately, according to the UNHCR and other reporters, when they do this, they know exactly what they're doing. This is an attempt to reduce the number of Palestinians. They use massacres on a huge scale. They use making life unbearable so that many Palestinians will leave and seek refuge somewhere else. But the killing is one way of keeping the numbers down as well.
Moscow has rejected a U.S. media report that a pro-Ukraine group was likely behind last year's attack on the undersea Nord Stream gas pipelines.
As for the pro-Ukrainian angle, you know, the idea that some Dr. Evil organized it, that's hard to believe. It was a too difficult task, which probably only a well-trained special state service was capable of, and there are not too many of them in our world.
The Kremlin spokesman also demanded a quick and transparent investigation into the blasts, adding that Moscow must be involved in that too. Peskov discarded a U.S. report that Moscow could have orchestrated the attacks. He said those responsible for the code terrorist act must be identified. On Tuesday, the New York Times cited U.S. intelligence officials as saying that a Ukrainian group might have carried out the attacks on the pipelines. The report presumed that the saboteurs were most likely Ukrainian or Russian, or a combination of both. Kiev responded to the allegations by denying any involvement. Russia has been pressing for an international probe since an American investigative journalist alleged Washington was behind the incidents. I cannot time now for the news review program. Police in the U.S. state of Kentucky have used excessive force, conducted illegal searches, and called black people using inappropriate names. This has been revealed in an investigation conducted by the Justice Department into the police killing of a young black woman. Brianna Taylor was fatally shot during a botched police raid on her apartment in Louisville in March 2020. The findings show Louisville police practice an aggressive style of policing that is deployed selectively against black people. The probe also accuses police of unjustified neck restraints and unreasonable use of dogs and tasers. Police were also found to have used minor offenses as a pretext to investigate unrelated criminal activity. Taylor's death was followed by the May 2020 police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. The two cases brought such deaths to greater public attention, sparking widespread protests and riots across the United States. With us is Netva Freeman. He's a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace in Washington, D.C. Okay. As well, let's have your opinion. Are the reforms the solution to the problem?
No, we can't reform a system of settler colonialism. The only solution to system of settler colonialism, which is what this is decolonization, is that for those who are colonized to be able to establish liberation and a system of their own, their right to self-determination. So what we see in the practices and what's come out in this report, numerous reports come out around these police things, but this latest one in Memphis shows that these practices are legacies of the slave patrols and the slave catchers during slavery and enslaved Africans and also against the indigenous people, and the need to colonize, to control the colonized subjects of settler colonialism. And so today's police actually why we can see that a lot of them also belong to white supremacist groups and those with white nationalist tendencies, and because the policing in the United States finds fertile ground among these most among these populations, that you might realize who think that this is a way to do something for the community and address the different crimes and violence and things, but those things are also a product of the disenfranchisement, the frustration and despair of neoliberalism of the U.S., the neoliberalism adopted by the U.S. settler colonial system. And so now we're seeing an intensification. The U.S., I mean, in spite of these reforms that they implement, they're actually intensifying the police. They're militarizing them. The federal government is giving more money to it. And so when they do these slight reforms, and even when they prosecute a particular cop, that's just one taking one for the team. And it's public relations ploy to save faces, as Reverend Hagler put it. But it's also meant to sustain, keep the system and keep the people confused about the nature, the inherent nature of this system.
Mm-hmm. And Netva, that system we're talking about seems to be so deeply entrenched within U.S. society. I mean, because it doesn't seem to be making a difference of which administration takes the realm of the White House, you know, Democrat or Republican, whoever comes to office. I mean, not much change for the better. That's not what we see. It's almost getting worse and worse, right?
It has to get worse. I mean, if we look, and unfortunately, it has to get worse in terms of what those in control will mete out. And we actually see it internationally as well. It's the same thing. This system, the U.S. government, is predicated on settler colonialism. That means a nationalism at the expense of Black, brown, indigenous, working class people in this country. And it also, because it's also an imperialist system, it is struggling and desperate attempt to control and exercise its hegemony around the world. The racism of it says that African people and brown people and other working class peoples, non-white peoples, are not capable of governing themselves. This is the trope, this is the mentality they have, but it's really about controlling and being able to exploit this system. You can see it's mirrored in the U.S. hegemonic dispositions around the world, in Haiti and Somalia, Libya and Palestine, which you just got finished talking about. And these imperialist forces are one U.S., NATO, EU axis of domination is how we refer to it. And neoliberalism is unsustainable. So it can't absorb the populations. There's no employment. They can't do anything for them. So their only recourse is to control and contain, mass incarcerate, kill, and murder us.
Okay, thank you so much for that, Netva Freeman, coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace in Washington, D.C. And with that, we come to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
Muscle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
A recent trail derailment in Ohio has sparked environmental concerns across the United States. The crane carried hazardous chemicals, raising concerns for wildlife, fish, and water quality. The train derailment led to a significant fire, which officials decided to let burn. Environmental researchers say the combustion of these chemicals almost certainly created dioxins, a highly toxic chemical that can remain in the environment for many years. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Washington Post has covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, has so far ignored testing toxic pollutants that could have been released into the air, soil and water around East Palestine, a village in Ohio, nearly a month after a train crashed and spewed toxic chemicals in the village. Recently, a Norfolk Southern train carrying hazardous chemicals derailed in East Palestine, Ohio, and exploded, spewing chemicals into the environment. In order to avoid a catastrophic explosion, the town's authorities released and burnt the contents of 5 tankers full of vinyl chloride, which created dioxin. Stephen Lester, science director for the Center for Health, Environment and Justice, said, "Testing for dioxin, a highly toxic substance, should have been one of the first things to look for, especially in the air, once the decision was made to burn the vinyl chloride. There is no question that dioxins were formed in the vinyl chloride fire. One of the residents who lived just 15 miles away described burnt ash material from the fire that settled on her property. The key point is that without a test, no one will understand if they're affected by dioxin." While Environmental Protection Agency officials said monitoring for related chemicals around East Palestine suggests a low probability for dioxin contamination, EPA Administrator Michael Regan said the agency is directing the railroad to conduct testing for the pollutants based on concerns from the community. Stephen Lester said testing dioxin is important because of the adverse health effects associated with exposure to dioxins that can cause cancer, reproductive damage, developmental problems, type 2 diabetes, ischemic heart disease, infertility in adults, impairment of the immune system, and skin lesions. She added, "Why is the Environmental Protection Agency unwilling to test for dioxins in the soil? My guess is because they know they will find it, and if they do find it, they'll have to address the many questions people are asking. It will not be easy to interpret the results of the testing for dioxins in soil, but to avoid testing is totally irresponsible. If dioxins are found at a level that poses any unacceptable risk to human health and the Environmental Protection Agency will direct the immediate cleanup of the area as needed. Experts warn that it will likely take years to complete the cleanup of East Palestine, if it can ever be considered truly complete." A chorus of academics, environmentalists, and residents have been raising the alarm over the potential dioxin contamination in East Palestine, Ohio, because days after the derailment, authorities seeking to avoid an explosion purposefully released and burnt the chemical vinyl chloride, a key component of PVC plastic. Dioxins are produced when burning anything from wood and fossil fuels to municipal waste and cigarettes. Combustion releases chlorine stored in these substances, which reacts with other compounds to form dioxins. Dioxins are linked to cancer, reproductive and developmental problems, and damage to the body's immune system. They're particularly troublesome toxins because they're slow to break down in the environment and also build up in the food chain. The Environmental Protection Agency says most human exposure to dioxins in the United States is tied to releases that occurred decades ago. NBC News has also covered this story and tells us more. Western Pennsylvania residents living near the Ohio border say they have been left out of recovery efforts following the February 3rd Norfolk Southern Trail derailment in neighboring East Palestine, Ohio. The crash led to evacuation and fears of air, water, and soil contamination, especially after one chemical was deliberately released and burnt to prevent an explosion. Pennsylvania residents say they are frustrated by a lack of information about the lasting risk from the disaster and demand more transparency from state and federal officials, who they say are focused too narrowly on recovery efforts within a 2-mile radius surrounding the derailment, a designation set by the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. Patty Barber, who lives in Darlington, Pennsylvania, less than 1 mile from the spill site, said, "Nobody is doing anything to help us. Pennsylvania is being left out." Ohio Governor Josh Shapiro announced the opening of a health clinic in Beaver and Lawrence counties that closely mirrors one created for East Palestine residents. Recently, the Environmental Protection Agency claimed East Palestine's municipal water was safe to drink, adding, "Indoor air quality screenings from more than 550 homes in the village did not exceed safety standards, and air quality in the community remains normal." But residents who live outside the immediate area say crucial information is hard to come by, even by people who complain of various ailments, including bronchitis, headaches, and other symptoms associated with chemical exposure. Many thousands of fish in the area have died, and community members have talked about finding sick pets and sick wildlife. Sherry Stroza, who lives about 3 miles away from the trail derailment site in Lawrence County, Pennsylvania, said she has experienced headaches since the chemical spill and worries about the safety of her dog and her 3 horses. A yellow-white residue now covers part of her soil, which Stroza has not been able to test despite repeated calls to state and federal environment agencies and local testing companies. Sherry Stroza said, "I called the DEP, I called the Environmental Protection Agency. They keep telling me I'm outside the range of the testing area. I would feel more comfortable if I could get my soil tested, but I don't know how." A spokesman for the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, the DEP, said the agency is testing private wells within a 2-mile radius of the derailment site and developing its soil sampling plan. Department spokesman Jamar Thrasher said in a statement, "It intends to aggressively pursue recovery of those costs from Norfolk Southern." He encouraged residents like Sherry Stroza, who live outside the 2-mile boundary, to contact the department directly to request testing. Leah Rennie Markovitz, who lives 25 miles from East Palestine in Clinton, Pennsylvania, said her biggest concern is the health of her children, who have experienced cold-like symptoms in recent weeks, and contaminated water leaching into her well. Many of her concerns were underscored on 17th of February during a 5-hour Pennsylvania State Senate Committee hearing. 8 community members shared their worries and frustrations, with most saying they felt like Pennsylvania had been abandoned. Lawrence County resident Sheila Steigler, who lives 16 miles away from where the train derailed, told lawmakers she's angry and heartbroken by what she calls a slow response from the state. She described her family as modern-day homesteaders who grow their own food and buy what they can't grow from local farmers. She now worries about the long-term impacts of the derailment to her food and her family. She said, "We faced uncertainty and felt abandoned and on our own." In Darlington, Patty Barber said she still doesn't know if her house is safe. She and her family didn't see birds fly over their rural home for about a week after the trail derailment.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Well, listeners of IRB English Radio, this is a new episode of your favorite program, Muslim Ladies. So welcome to this new episode in which we're going to talk about pretty much of a stuff that is all related to women. And as usual, we have Sister Zainab in here. Assalamu alaikum, Sister.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, Sister Zainab, as you already know, this is the week of the birthday of Imam Mahdi, ajalallah farajah. And we can see that everywhere is decorated and all the people are so happy for this birthday. Of course, I offer my congratulations as well. We start thinking about, okay, we know that there is a role for men after the appearance of Imam Mahdi, ajalallah farajah, and also before that, when he's not, actually, when there is no appearance. So let's talk about the role of women before the appearance and also after the appearance. How are we going to cooperate?
Yeah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A very, actually, nice question, because it said that jihad is for men.
Yeah.
And then there may be some war kind of thing when Imam is going to reappear. I also extend in the beginning my congratulations in this beautiful month of Shaban to you and to dear listeners. And let's know more about Imam in this time, because the more we know about him, the more we get close to him, and the more we get close to him, as per narrations, we get closer to Allah. We attain that proximity, and that, because that's how narrations have been answered, how to attain proximity towards Allah, by having the knowledge about the Imam of your time. Anyways, moving ahead, I was saying that we have this concept that jihad is for men, and that when Imam is going to reappear, there is going to be some war kind of thing. So men have to be his soldiers. Can women be his soldiers or not? Mm-hmm. Of course, they can be after, not just after his reappearance, but also before his reappearance, in terms of providing the necessary grounds for reappearance. Now, how can women actually provide those grounds, especially a Muslim lady who is listening to our show right now? It is first thing that you gotta realize is that you are a human being.
Yeah.
What the media is actually trying to portray today, and what history has shown us from the very beginning, like since the time, ignorant time in Arab, why would they bury a woman alive? Mm-hmm. Why would they bury a girl child alive? Was because of that ignorant period and not actually considering her a human being.
Yeah, so, the human soul that existed in that girl.
Or a valuable soul. Yeah. They would have not done that heinous crime that, you know, dug them all alive. So first of all, not just the society, a woman herself got to realize that she is a human being. Because what is being portrayed in media is that you are a tool, not a human being. For mm-hmm. example, I got to do the advertisement of my cosmetic products.
Yeah.
And to show that my products work well, because I'm earning money through that, I use women as a tool. You can see most of the advertisements are that of women.
Mm-hmm.
Hair, she's not being used as a human being.
And they actually try to make her feel that this is not the aim of what they're doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. See how with love, with passion, women come and they do these advertisements of those beauty products and all. Now, I'm not saying that women can't do any advertisements. Women are not authorized to do advertisements. I'm not here to say something about fake. But what I'm trying to say is, whatever you're doing, whatever you're being offered, just see, is my being human?
Yeah, or your body, your beauty, or things like so mundane and worldly.
Hair, wherever the body image becomes the focus,
yeah,
there a woman is definitely seen as a tool.
The humanity of that person lowers down. And that's it all. So right now, let's go for a short break and then we'll catch up for the rest.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So welcome back, Muslim ladies. We're talking about the duties of women in the age of Imam and how they can cooperate with men in the society and having some roles. And Sister Zainab was giving us some introduction into this issue. And then we were talking about women being used as a tool in different advertisements and things like that. So, Sister Zainab, what more?
Yeah, it's not just only advertisements. I gave a very small example. But everywhere, you know, I was saying in general, whenever you as a woman are offered anything in the society, in the businesses, in the market, in every... anywhere, just realize this offer, what does it contain? Mm-hmm. Is it taking me out of my being human frame?
Exactly.
If it takes me out, I do not accept this offer. Why do I need to accept this offer? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in Surah Talaq that do practice taqwa and I will be giving you from the ways that you have never imagined.
So, as I understand, we could say, we could put it this way, that my first duty and role is to respect my dignity and humanity more than anything else.
More than anything else. Yeah. And there could be, because I know some women have actually realized this. I have met them personally who say, all right, we do realize this, but we are forced. We are forced to work, because if we do not work this way, if we do not work in this environment, if I do not show off myself as a tool in this company, in this society, in this particular, I don't know, field, then I won't be gaining money. I won't be able to feed my family. I won't be able to, I don't know, carry out many things, you know. First of all, we have to have, when we go and buy Quran, we try to buy best of the prints. We try to buy best of the fonts. We try to put it in best of the packages.
The beautiful
we try
to put covers.
It in the top of the shelves. It's not that. It's actually going into it. This apparent respecting Quran is fine, but what is actually more important is taking deep dive into the verses. As I mentioned, Surah Talaq says that, and it's also recommended, go and say these verses after your prayers, especially the Zuhra's prayers. Say these two, verse number 2 and 3, which say that if you practice taqwa, you don't even imagine, you won't imagine where from Allah is going to send you. I have personally realized this.
Which actually doesn't mean that you're not going through terrible and difficulties. No, on the contrary, you might face too much of obstacles. But the thing is that God is going to pull you through that.
Exactly. You never know where from God is actually going to give you. You sometimes get offers like you never knew
exactly.
Where from Allah is going to send me, where from Allah is going to... I'll give you some of examples. Like, for example, I was getting offers from different countries that you work here, but you had to work from 9 to 5. And I was actually thinking to myself, a woman, 9 to 5 work for a woman, how she's going to manage home then, how she's going to manage
exactly
a child then, how she's going to manage...
Even herself.
Herself, her family, anything, you know? So for me, like, I personally don't prefer 9 to 5 jobs. So I kind of was providing handsome salary, obviously.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I just kept that aside and then, you know, that went into some another environment and it started writing some kind of poetry. And I swear, within no time, for that poetry, in Iran, I was invited into different stees and I had been just going around.
Now, I get what you say. Just the gist of what we were saying. Difficulties are there. That doesn't mean that if I go for Allah and I respect my dignity, I would... everything is going to go so cheery.
Because I was writing something for him. I was writing something for Ahlul Bayt, you know? Mm-hmm. And within no time, they were inviting me here, there.
They would shower you with too much of blessings.
Yeah, and I never expected that. So there are many more experiences in my life like that. I don't want to mention all of them here. The first thing that you can do as a woman, what's your duty towards the imam of your time, is that realize that you're a human being, not a tool.
Exactly.
All right?
So this is the point. Let's keep it there. Go for a short break, and then we'll come for the rest. ladies, we are talking about what is our concern, which is our role and duty in society when we are living in the time of Imam, and we want to know how we could cooperate in this age. So Sister Zainab was telling us that the first and the most important role that we have is to respect our dignity and our humanity above anything else.
Yeah. First of all, realize that you are a human being, not a tool. Second, do realize that you are a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because what is being fed to you through different sources.
Media and the modern world.
You are equal to men. You're
exactly.
Not.
Yeah, you're not.
If you should have equal, you should be having the, you can see the feminism.
And tell you something, when we say we're not equal to men, we do not mean to degrade ourselves. No, there are some very vivid differences.
We have some rights that men crave for.
Yeah.
And men don't have them. So everybody has, Islam's actually balanced everything.
Exactly.
That balance is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Equality is not balance. Balance is justice.
Exactly.
Balance is being fair. And Allah and Islam is all fair. So you got to be realizing one thing, mm-hmm. that you're a human being and you're a woman. And what society is trying to teach you, or what media is going to is trying to feed you through different content, is that no, come on, you're equal to men, and since you're not, you are.
And equal, actually, they're
that's
going
what
to...
justice. Justice never means equality. Justice means balance.
Mm-hmm.
Putting everything at its own place is called justice. But what media is teaching us, it's just giving us a very awkward definition of being fair and being just.
It's
justice
a wrong
is not
notion.
Equality. We should realize and
it's actually
know that.
A wrong notion that is going to put much of burden on women's shoulder.
Yeah. So she got to realize her value. She got to, because she is a bringing a generation. So she has to realize, all right, it's not like I am a woman and I should be as strong as men and I should be having highest posts. All right, Islam has given you the highest post inside the family. That is, you are, if you're going to be modest, if you're going to be actually practicing piety. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to practice piety, you are actually upbringing not just one generation. You are upbringing generations with your piety. So you actually can create a strong family when you realize these positions. You can create a strong family, safe society. And creating a strong family and safer society is in itself, you're creating... You are the creator of the soldiers of Imam. That's your biggest jihad, to create a strong family, to be alongside with your husband in his dark and bright times.
Exactly, yeah. So thank you, Sister Zainab. This is actually all the time that we have for today's episode. Thank you for listening. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. May Allah shower you with his blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Who is the Lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity.
La ilaha illallah.
Muhammadur Rasulullah.
Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, so Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men. and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
There are reports that a Pennsylvania hospital is attempting to deport an undocumented woman in a coma. Although the practice is illegal, medical deportations have become a profitable industry in the United States of America. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out wrote in this regard, after medical personnel induced an undocumented woman into a coma, administrators in a hospital in Allentown, Pennsylvania, are trying to deport her to the Dominican Republic, despite the risks to her life and her husband's opposition. The hospital is pushing through its decision, known as medical deportation, even though it is technically illegal, as the federal government has the exclusive authority to remove individuals from the U.S. If they put her on a plane, my wife is going to die. They haven't even put back the piece of the skull they removed from her to relieve the swelling in her brain, said Junior Rivas, who asked to use a pseudonym to protect his immigration status in the U.S., adding, "My wife has a huge hole in her head, and on the side where the piece of a skull is missing, something seems to be coming out." According to Rivas, his wife, a 46-year-old mother of two children, signed the admission paperwork herself at the Lehigh Valley Hospital Cedar Crest on December 28. One day later, she underwent what the medical staff told Rivas was a relatively simple procedure to treat her aneurysm. The surgery did not go as expected, and on December 30, doctors put her under an induced coma. Since then, the hospital personnel asked Rivas if he wanted to disconnect her. When he declined, they kept insisting. Rivas said the hospital gave him three options on February 27th. Pay for $500 per day equipment to take care of his wife in their home, find another U.S. hospital that would admit her or consent to her deportation to the Dominican Republic. They gave him 48 hours to decide before they started her wife's deportation arrangement. On March 2nd, Rivas received a letter in English from the hospital saying they would give him 7 additional days to pick one of the choices presented to him. A group of local nonprofits and grassroots organizations has been attempting to stop the deportation by bringing attention to the case and protesting at the hospital since March 1st. This seems to be the only way to stop medical deportation, as hospitals and transportation companies rely on the fact that undocumented immigrants avoid bringing attention to themselves. Medical deportations are not legal, said Lisa Sun-Hick Park, a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and an author of a 2022 paper on medical deportations, adding, "Only the federal government has the authority to forcibly remove an individual to another country. Unfortunately, there are a lot of gray areas here because hospitals are pretty adamant in saying that these are not deportations." The hospitals, however, tend to coerce individuals into agreeing to their own removal or that of their loved ones. So medical deportations only come to light when the patient or their guardian disputes them and the legality of the action is questioned. There is no official accounting or regulation for this practice, which happens without the involvement of immigration courts or the Department of Homeland Security, which is in charge of implementing immigration law and is the parent agency of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, and Customs and Border Protection, CBP. Lacking oversight, medical deportations seem to happen on a massive scale. A Seoul hospital in Phoenix reportedly repatriated approximately 100 patients a year. I try to look up every single case that has been talked about in the media or legal documents, and my best guess, conservatively, is that it is in the hundreds every year. But if I were more realistic, I would say it must be in the thousands in the U.S., Park said. As previously reported by Prism and the New York Times, although consented medical repatriations are common in the U.S., most medical deportees seem to be undocumented immigrants from Latin America, impoverished individuals transferred to subpar clinics in the region. An industry has flourished. More than 350 airplane ambulances capable of medically deporting people operate in the U.S., according to the 2021 report, Fatal Flights, Medical Deportation in the U.S., by the Legislative Clinic at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School and Free Migration Project, a nonprofit advocating for abolishing deportations. One company alone, Med Escort International, also based in Allentown, Pennsylvania, boasts about transporting over 6,000 patients to more than 100 countries. Its website allows access to it as social worker or family member or as hospital CEO or CFO looking to solve the problem of unfunded foreign patients. According to Truthout, the industry has financial incentives to expand medical deportations. Rivas said that he has identified a New York clinic that agreed to admit his wife, but as of March 2nd, the Lehigh Valley Hospital staff had not communicated with New York option for a possible transfer. He said, "These people want to send my wife to the Dominican Republic." For medical transportation companies, this is their business model. They rely on these deportations to make revenue, said Adriana Torres-Garcia, deputy director of the Free Migration Project, adding, these companies have a stake in coercing a patient into consent, along with a hospital, so they can deport a person. Deporting Rivas' wife may also relieve the Lehigh Valley Hospital, Cedar Crest, part of a multi-campus healthcare network in eastern Pennsylvania, whose revenue jumped 11% from 2021 to 2022 to $3.8 billion of another challenge, potential medical malpractice. Rivas contends that his wife may have been negligently damaged during the procedure to clip her aneurysm. The medical staff, he said, refuses to provide her medical records, even though a hospital is legally obliged to provide medical records to the guardian of a patient. The staff has not done so as of March 2nd. David Bennion, executive director of Free Migration Project, said, I would not rule out medical malpractice. In other cases we've worked on, the family and the health advocates always had concerns whether the patient was receiving appropriate care. Hospitals do all kinds of things to cover up that information, like not providing copies of the medical files. The Lehigh Valley Hospital Network president and senior vice president did not reply to PRISM's request to comment on this story. For now, Rivas is fighting, along with advocates, nonprofits, and grassroots organizations, to keep his wife in the U.S. As of March 2nd, she remains in the Lehigh Valley Hospital. Otherwise, it will be harder to get any kind of accountability. Bennion said, as far as we are aware, no U.S. court has ever held a hospital or a transport company accountable for a medical deportation, even if it resulted in death or serious injury. There is no enforcement mechanism for this, so effectively, it does not matter if these companies are breaking the law.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.